You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Juneteenth. It's Friday. I'm Kevin Richard from Idaho Education News. I'm sitting in for Gemma Gaudette, who's on vacation, but the news isn't on vacation, and it's time for our reporter roundtable when we get you caught up on all the news that made headlines this week. Our panel includes Kelsey Mosley Morris, a reporter at the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, the opinion editor at the Idaho Statesman, and Margaret Carmel, senior reporter from BoiseDev.com. Hello, all.
Hello, Kevin.
So we've got a lot to get to this week. We're going to kind of begin with a segment that it's kind of the hang on, listeners, don't fade out. This stuff is really important kind of section of the show, because these are fairly wonky topics, but they're also really interesting topics. And Scott, I'm going to kick it off with you. Redistricting. It's kind of a dense topic, but if you're a legislator and you're thinking about where you're going to be running and who you're going to be representing, it's blood sport, and it's going to start in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I figured you would lead with this, Kevin, because I know back in 2011, you wrote quite a bit about this, and you recognized that this was a dense topic from reading your stories on this topic. But
it's still dense a decade later, but it's still important.
Right. Absolutely. This happens every 10 years after the census, that the populations are recalculated and new legislative districts are drawn based on those census numbers. The census numbers are late this year. Usually they come in March.
Right.
But because of the pandemic, the Census Bureau had to delay the release of their numbers. And you know, a lot of public officials have been waiting with bated breath to see when these numbers are going to come out. And Keith Bybee of the Legislative Services Office told me this week that they're going to get those numbers by August 16th, and they can begin work on this redistricting, which is good news that it's going to be, you know, sooner rather than later, because they're going to be on a tight deadline. This redistricting commission is appointed by three Republicans and three Democrats, and this is by constitutional amendment passed mm-hmm. by voters, Idaho voters, in 1994. And this commission is going to get to work, you know, determining what the legislative district boundaries are. It's also going to draw the congressional district line. So that's probably going to move farther west, or it might be redrawn altogether. Mm-hmm. So the work that this commission does is going to determine what legislative district you live in, what congressional district you live in. It might change based on their work. And, you know, what we know is that population has grown in the Treasure Valley relative to rural Idaho. So
we'll have more legislators from this corner of the state, but legislative districts around the state are going to be, you know, a lot larger, and you could have incumbents squaring off in the same legislative district.
Right. And that's what is inevitable, because the voters, you might remember, in 2020 approved a constitutional amendment that capped the number of legislative districts at 35. And so we have more people in Idaho, but the same number of legislative districts. So that just means that some of these districts are gonna be bigger. The estimate is about 53,000 people per legislative district.
Wow.
Currently, it's about 45,000 per district. And so that number is going to go up even more. And so we already have some really massive geographically situated legislative districts, and those are just going to get even bigger. And as the population is denser in places like Boise and Ada County and Canyon County, you're going to get more legislative districts, so more representation in the Treasure Valley, in places that have grown in population. Go ahead.
And at the end of the day, it's kind of imposed by partisanship, because the only way for this map to work is that the three Democrats and the three Republicans have to come to some sort of an agreement that the majority can support.
Exactly. It requires, the final maps require at least four out of the six members. So somebody from one party is going to have to, you know, go along with the other three in the other party. And so the numbers were expected to get August 16th. There'll be some preliminary work and some you know, paperwork that needs to be filed. And so probably the commission will start meeting in September, probably after Labor Day. And then they have 90 days to complete their work. Now, hopefully they don't take all 90 days because that would put them into December. And from what everyone has said, it's going to get a legal challenge. It's almost a fait accompli that it's going to get challenged legally. And so then that's got to go to the Idaho Supreme Court. And if that takes some time and the commission has to come back and do the work again or reconfigure some districts, it's going to be pushing up against a deadline of February 28th for candidates to file their paperwork to declare their candidacy for the state legislature. So they've got to get that work done by then, or else they're going to have to push that filing deadline back.
Well, either way, I'll see you in September for the start of the hearings.
It'll be interesting.
It will be. Kelsey, you've been writing about another wonky topic that's near and dear to my heart, tax exemptions. And
yes, very wonky.
Very wonky, but very important because the magnitude of Idaho's tax exemptions, it means that there's a lot of money that potentially could be on the books, but isn't on the books. And Idaho really doesn't review its exemptions as closely, as carefully as other states do. And that's something you've been writing about.
Yeah. In my first installment of this series that I've been working on, I talked about how there's about $4 billion that goes uncollected because of these exemptions and deductions and credits. And so I wanted to take a look at some of the states that surround us that do review their tax processes, which the only ones that don't are Nevada and Wyoming. And kind of the polar opposites are Montana and Washington. So I looked at those two because Montana looks just at credits and Washington reviews every single one of their exemptions, credits, deductions every 10 years. And they have about 700 compared to ours, which is about 165 that we know about.
Wow.
I can't remember. I don't think Montana even knows how many they have, but they only do credits. And they try to look at those because those are incentives that are marked by, you know, something like solar panels for people's houses. And they want to make sure that those are still viable as incentives because now solar is kind of a normal thing there.
Sure.
So they don't really need it anymore. According to industry experts too, they take a lot of testimony on that. And then Washington's very comprehensive with its process, and they have, it's kind of dependent on staffing as well, because Washington has a ton of legislative staff, and they're sort of a hybrid model. They're not exactly a full-time legislature, but they're not part-time either, like Idaho's, and Montana's much closer to our system. So it's just interesting to see kind of the differences between those states and their population size. I think Montana's probably a little more feasible for us, but it's going to depend on just the appetite for it in the legislature too, and what can be done.
Right, because the level of review that Idaho has given to these exemptions has been fairly limited, and the political history has been pretty straightforward. You know, it's a lot easier to get an exemption written into the code than it is to try to get one written out of the code.
For sure. And I think limited is putting it mildly, because we don't even have sunset clauses on any of our exemptions or deductions or anything. So stuff that's been on the books since 1929 has never been touched from what we know. And some of the stuff that's been in there since the 80s, we don't even have an estimate of how much we're not collecting for those exemptions. So there's just a lot of unknowns right now.
And Margaret, you're writing about something that, again, it's really wonky, but it's also really important, and it's something that voters are going to have to decide on in November. It's not a governor's race, so it's not as exciting as a governor's race, but it is really important to Boise ratepayers and Boise taxpayers.
Yeah, so in November, there's going to be a bond for Boise voters if they would like to take out debt in order to pay for the next decade's worth of wastewater improvements. And this would fund redoing massive amounts of infrastructure that dates back to the 40s and the 50s. That's just kind of reached the end of its useful life. New growth, and the city is looking at some new innovations for recycled water that would help kind of move the the city into the future as far as conserving water as things get more scarce, as the climate warms and we have more people here. The
thing I was kind of floored by the cost, but we're talking about $1 billion worth of work over the next 20 years.
Yes, it is an insanely high price tag. And that's something that a lot of municipalities around the country are going through right now, where basically this country built a lot of wastewater infrastructure and water infrastructure during World War II, the New Deal. A lot of that stuff was built. And then now all of that is basically breaking down. Plus we have all this exponential population growth here, and it just results in a huge price tag. I mean, the water renewal facility on Lander Street off of State is, you know, really, it's like 80 years old at this point. And they have to essentially replace that whole thing from top to bottom, let alone build these new facilities and pursue recycled water and some of these other things that they say they need to do in order to meet federal compliance and just to keep the toilets flushing. That's not something you can just decide, too expensive, don't feel like doing that. So this bond, essentially what it will do is, if voters vote for this and it needs 50% majority, it will hike rates slowly over time to pay for this as the city, because the city will be basically taking out debt to do this project. Roughly 9%, between 9 and 10% for the next 10 years or 5 years. And then you will see that hike amount decrease. And so it's kind of just a slow increase. But if voters decide they would like to pay for this stuff in cash, there will be a bit up to 53% rate hike in next year, basically taking all of that rate hike all at once. And then it will continue to climb up over the next, it will continue to climb up that same 9% in the next 5 years before leveling out as we head into 2040. And what this will do, it's essentially like whenever you have, you're buying a house and you ideally you have the money in your pocket to pay for it in cash, but if you borrow, you're gonna pay for it in a smaller amount of time over the years, but you will pay interest. So this will end up costing more, but it will be less of a rate shock now. And some of the arguments from city council members for why they want to pass this, they want to put this bond up, is because they're saying doing the bond basically means that all of the people coming to Boise and moving here will pay for this, the improvements and the things they're going to be needing, as opposed to if we do it all at once in cash, then the people here now will pay for a bunch of things that people that aren't even here yet will be using. So it's kind of a way to spread out that cost and make sure everyone pays. So we'll see. It depends on how the voters want to approach it. And I'm really curious to see how this is going to shake out, especially because Boise will be elected by district this November. There are some areas of the city where this will be the only question on your ballot, because
the turnout could be really low.
They will not be able to vote for a city council member at large anymore. So even if you're not in a district that will be up, pay attention to this bond.
I know you'll be writing a lot more about this between now and November, and we'll be watching. We're going to take a short break right now, but we're going to stick with growth topics when we come back with our reporter roundtable. I'm Kevin Richard, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Kevin Richard. Continuing with our reporter roundtable, our guests today are Kelsey Mosley Morris, a reporter at the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, the opinion editor at the Idaho Statesman, and Margaret Carmel, senior reporter at BoiseDev.com. It's easy to spend a lot of time talking about Treasure Valley growth issues, and there were several that came up in the past few days. Margaret, I'm going to start with you. You spent some time Thursday covering a pretty contentious meeting about housing density in one section of town. Give us the details.
Yeah, so there's a park, or it's a park site over in Southwest Boise. It's 160 acres and it's been owned by the city since the 90s. And it's just been sitting there, just being farmed by a local farmer paying the city a small lease. And it's been marked for a long time as a potential park site, but the city has never allocated any funding for it. It's never been in a capital plan, and it's estimated it would cost between 30 and 35 million just to put grass on it. And something else, it wasn't even in the city limits until it's not even in the city limits. So the city has been approached by a developer that is proposing to do a land swap where they swap some land they own in the foothills for this 160 acre parcel and put some sort of housing on it with a 7-acre neighborhood park, and then possibly attached a 40 acre parcel of parkland owned by the school district that has an office nearby. And the neighborhood is really upset about this. They're saying that, you know, they're saying that they deserve to have a large park in that area of town.
We have this whole "don't steal our park" hashtag going on.
Right. And instead of building more housing on the project, and the city is countering and saying, well, this area was never annexed as part of, you know, this area was never annexed into the city. The neighborhood south of Victory has been really opposed to any sort of annexation in the past. And so there hasn't really been as much, you know, as much the tax dollar support needed to build a park of that size. And, you know, they also say that there are there's enough athletic fields in the city to meet the current demand. And there are two nearby parks, the 20 acre Molinar Park and another park, Peppermint Park, that have come online in recent years. And so they can do this scaled down park. There's going to be a series of hearings coming up in the next few months as city council decides if they're going to continue talking to this developer, and we learn who the developer is, because there's a whole lot of questions related to this. So this is going to be an issue to watch. And it comes to really this issue of what happens with these services of people who live on the edge of the city of Boise, or people who are in the area of impact, but they are not in the city. The city is saying that they need funds to support those types of projects. But the residents are, you know, they're frustrated because they see, well, you're taking our park and putting it in for open land in the foothills where there's already a lot of open space that will benefit, you know, people who live in the North End who can already go to all these parks. So it was quite the meeting last night. There was over 400 people logged on and nearly 300 questions in the Zoom chat box.
And you spent part of your day on Thursday covering a meeting in a different section of town where residents are concerned about housing density.
Yeah, so on Tuesday night, the city council had a, okay, I see what you mean. Okay, so last Thursday, there was a meeting about the zoning code.
I'm sorry, I'm going back a week, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay, the dates just messed me up. So last week, there was a meeting with folks in Northwest Boise about the new zoning code rewrite. And the city is undergoing this process right now to basically rewrite all the rules where you decide where housing can go, density can go. And the Northwest is pretty upset about this because some of the initial proposals, they're wanting to open up more residential density on more parcels and saying that different parcels have the ability to have up to a fourplex, a triplex, and all these things by right instead of requiring a rezone or a planned unit development. And it will basically allow more housing density in the city as the city grows. And the Northwest Boise, if you've ever been over there, it's kind of a semi-rural area. A lot of the people who live out there are on large 1-acre lots. They have livestock, chickens, large gardens they flood irrigate. It's a different situation than you see than you see in the closer to the city where there's a lot more density. And they have long been frustrated that they feel like the city of Boise is foisting this density on them. And so I went to this 2-hour meeting about the zoning code. There was a lot of pointed questions from the people in the audience who feel frustrated by all of this development and that the city is building their zoning code in a way that doesn't preserve large lots. And they, you know, there were several questions of, well, how can we get density that basically keeps that area the way that it is in, you know, in perpetuity instead of allowing density to encroach. And it's this zoning code issue is going to be a major talking point in the next year. And I think that meeting of just people's anxiety about their neighborhoods changing and density growing and how the city policy plays into that is just a small taste of what we're going to see in the next year as this process continues.
And Scott, let me turn to you here. Over the past few days, we've had a couple of pretty pricey and maybe even surprising land auctions unfold in the Treasure Valley. And I know you're tracking that and what it might mean in terms of the housing development front.
Right. Yeah, there's a couple of eye-popping land auctions that just recently happened just this month. Corey Barton last week of CBH Homes bought 282 acres of state farmland near Caldwell in a state auction for $36.6 million, or about $130,000 per acre. But then earlier in the month, Matt Bauscher, a partner in a Boise-based real estate brokerage firm, bought 34.5 acres of parkland that was owned by the city of Eagle for $9.1 million at auction. Even though that amount is not as high, the per acreage is $264,000 an acre. And so these are just kind of astronomical levels that we haven't heard of in quite some time, at least probably since the 06, 07 boom times. And so you might look at those and say, oh, great. Well, this is not going to help affordable housing because now, you know, if they're going to be, you know, spending that much money on land alone, they're going to need to sell $1 million or $2 million or $5 million houses, and that's going to drive up prices. But in reality, building million-dollar homes is actually going to help housing affordability. And here's why. A few months ago, Idaho Statesman reporter John Soule wrote a story that Kelsey is very familiar with. He wrote a story about a house in Kelsey's neighborhood that sold for $1 million. And the house was assessed at $534,000. And so here's a house, you know, $500,000 house selling for $1 million. And that's because it's a matter of supply and demand. The supply is just really low, and apparently it's really low for $1 million houses. And so folks who have $1 million to spend on a house, they're going and finding the best available house that they can find. And so they're going and finding, you know, a house in a typical subdivision in Meridian and paying $1 million for it. Well, if folks like Corey Barton and Matt Bauscher go in and start developing subdivisions of $1 million houses, well, that's where those $1 million house buyers are going to go. And they're going to go buy those and take pressure off of those houses that are $500,000, $600,000. Now, of course, you know, our housing supply is in short supply across the board, not just $1 million houses. We need right. more $200,000 houses and $500,000 houses. But, and for sure, these land auctions and the astronomical prices that they're going for is definitely a sign of our red hot housing market. But to think that that is only going to exacerbate the problem is false, that it actually will help the problem. We need more housing across the board. People are moving into Boise, whether we like it or not. And so building more housing at the top end and at the lower end, every unit that we can add to the market is going to help housing affordability.
Something else that I think is really important that doesn't get lost in this conversation is, you know, Scott is absolutely right. You don't fix housing prices by just saying we're not going to build anything and people coming here, they should not come here. That all that will do is just drive prices up because, you know, we can't build a wall around Idaho and stop people from coming here. But what really shouldn't you really should keep in mind is, and I've talked on this program about it, is just the proliferation of investors and other people coming in and buying up these all of these homes, not just at those high price points, but especially at these low price points. And it does have that impact of driving up prices because if, you know, hedge funds or pension funds are buying single family homes and flipping, that's going to jack up the prices. And so it's a combination of both things. I think on this debate, there's a lot of people who just land on the side of build that will solve the issue. And you're right, we absolutely need more supply. But that also takes away from that idea that the right now our housing market is being commodified, and there's a lot of people and entities purchasing these homes that are not just, you know, the Leave It to Beaver family down the road with two kids and a dog. It's, you know, it's a very different housing market than it was in, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And so I think that keeping both of those things in mind of just all these factors is important when talking about how supply impacts prices.
I think it's also worth pointing out that some of those business people are buying up rentals too, and not even selling them and just keeping them as rental markets. So that's driving prices as well.
I want to stick with this conversation about growth. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back in 2 minutes, Scott, I want you to talk about a tool that local governments may be able to use to figure out if housing developments pencil out. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Idaho Matters and the Reporter Roundtable. I'm Kevin Richard. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Kevin Richard. Continuing with our Reporter Roundtable with Kelsey Mosley-Morris, a reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, the opinion editor at the Idaho Statesman, and Margaret Carmel, the senior reporter at BoiseDev.com. We spent that last segment talking about growth, and Scott, I want you to take kind of a big picture look. You wrote recently about how a lot of these housing development decisions that are made at the local level, they're kind of binary decisions. But there's a new tool that local governments might be able to use to figure out if housing developments make sense, if new development, if new growth pays for itself.
Right. You think about how, you know, development decisions are made, and, you know, usually what happens is that a farmer sells 80 acres of his land and to a developer, and a developer says, you know, I want to develop 3 houses per acre. So I want to build a subdivision of 240 houses, and they go before planning and zoning and city council, and they debate it, and they talk about curb and gutter and sidewalk, and they talk about entrances, and, you know, maybe there's a little bit of open space, and maybe there's a little thing in there from ACHD saying, you know, that here's the current level of service for the roads, and you know, the school district sometimes weighs in, sometimes doesn't. And so then the city council is left with the decision, okay, do we approve this or do we not approve this? And then a few years later, the police department comes forward and says, oh, we need to hire 3 more officers. And the school district says, well, we need a $15 million bond to build a new school. And ACHD says, well, there's been 5 fatal accidents at this intersection, but we don't have the money to improve it with a traffic signal or a roundabout or whatever. And so, you know, we haven't been thinking about those long-term costs, particularly to other agencies. Well, now Compass, the Community Planning Association of Southwest Idaho, has developed this tool with Tischler Buys, a consulting firm, called a fiscal impact tool. And basically what it does, it calculates the cost, the long-term costs of any development, whether it's a subdivision or a big box store or a 20,000 square foot grocery store, and plugs it in to the tax calculations and figures out how much tax revenue would be generated by that development, and compares it with the amount of money needed to provide services, sewer, water, library, schools, police, fire services, and looks at all those expenses and determines, and it'll determine whether or when a development breaks even. So a lot of these calculations that they ran through as mock scenarios showed that the city would break even in 1 year or in 4 years or 5 years. They even look at Valley Regional Transit to see when they would break even based on the revenue that they collect from the cities and counties, whether it will break even at all. And I will say that in the mock scenarios that they drew up, ACHD often came out as doesn't break even at all. In other words, that the revenue generated from these developments seldom pay for the road improvements and maintenance that are necessary. So I think this is going to be really interesting. It's just rolling out. It's just getting started. Eagle has dipped their toe in the water with a couple of developments, and we'll see what those results are. It'll also be interesting to see what cities and counties actually start utilizing it and using it in their calculations when they're determining whether to approve a project or not. You know, there's some mitigation factors that could be taken into account. You know, if something doesn't break even, they could say, well, if you donate land for a new school, you know, maybe this will pencil out for the school district. Or if you donate land for a park and ride lot, this might pencil out for the Valley Regional Transit. Or if you enter into a CIP, a community improvement district to help build traffic signals or a roundabout near you, that might pencil out for ACHD. So I think this is a game changer, and this is really a unique tool. It's used in just a few places across the country. I think it's much needed in the Treasure Valley, and I think it will help decision makers make informed data-based decisions moving forward.
Something that I thought was really interesting about your article, Scott, was getting into the prices of a multifamily unit versus a single family home and 911 calls and all sorts of things like that. And I hear that a lot, where folks will be at city council meetings and there's this feeling saying, well, you should reject this dense multifamily development or denser, you know, housing subdivision, because density means more services, more expensive. But whenever you look at the numbers of actually, okay, a multifamily unit is only going to have X amount, like only a small amount more services, but because it's in a dense location, those folks are in, they're all in one place, and it doesn't end up costing ACHD as much. And I think that because it's not always just that more people in one place causes more services, it's the distance to get there. You know, if you picture a 20 unit apartment building, and then you imagine, I'm going to take every family that lives in that apartment and I'm going to put them in a single family house on a half acre lot, that just stretches out into the desert, right? Of how do we make room for all these people? And that is harder to serve and more time consuming and requires more officers than all those people living in one place together, especially if you put that 20 unit apartment building in the city, in a dense area where there's already patrols, there's already infrastructure, and that will especially cut down on, you know, building new roads and building four lane roads out where there's currently a farm road out in Western Meridian. So I think that Scott's right. Injecting more data and more numbers into these conversations will help, because a lot of times you sit in these hearings and a lot of people are making decisions and deciding how they feel about a project and whether it will be too much of a hit on a city budget based on how do I feel about it? Like, I don't, you know, how do they feel about it? And this kind of feeling that people who live in a single family home development are going to use less services than an apartment building. And really those things don't necessarily square up with what we're seeing in the data.
And let me shift a little bit. This is, it's an infrastructure story, but it was an interesting infrastructure story because it's not what I would expect to see, Kelsey. It's road construction season around the state usually, but only if you can get the raw materials that you need to get the job done. And in North Idaho, that's not necessarily been the case.
Yeah, it's kind of a combination of things. There's been, you know, reports of shortages in lumber and a lot of other materials, but also cement as a result of kind of a plant outage in, I think it might be Alberta, but it's somewhere in Canada that supplies the plant in Spokane that is supposed to go to the North Idaho project, where they're kind of milling up the road and then repaving it with cement. So it requires a lot of cement. And they're dealing with a lot of shortages in trucking as well, shortages in routes. And what I learned from the plant supplier was that there's been some interesting issues with routes that people are taking on trucking areas to deal with the pandemic. It sounds like things that have been affected by COVID-19 are making truck drivers make interesting decisions, is how he put it. And
interesting decisions.
Whatever okay. that means in COVID times. And that's just leading to a lot of, you know, hangups. And so it's, you know, a combination of demand, I think, too, because we've got so much building around here and around the state. There's places in Pocatello that are building new developments. And so there's just a lot of different moving parts right now when it comes to building anything.
Yeah. Yeah. As usual in the reporter roundtable, I feel like we have more topics than we have time. We have to take one last short break. I want to get back with all three of you in the final segment. I'm Kevin Richard, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Kevin Richard. Continuing our reporter roundtable with our guests this week, Kelsey Mosley Morris, a reporter at the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, the opinion editor at the Idaho Statesman, and Margaret Carmel, senior reporter at BoiseDev.com. We're going to go into this final few minutes. This is the topics Kevin really wants to make sure we get to before we have to sign off. Kelsey, I'm going to start with you. The name Charles Fain may ring some bells for folks who've been in the state for some time. Some closure in his death row case, personal closure, but also pretty significant closure and cost to the state here.
Yeah, Charles Fain is someone who spent 18 years on death row in Idaho before he was released in 2001 by Judge Windmill, based on some DNA evidence that exonerated him after he was incarcerated between the 80s and 2001. And so it's taken 20 years to get a certificate of innocence from the state saying that he was not the killer. It was a case of drowning and murdering of a 9-year-old girl in Nampa. And through some DNA work with the Kinney County Sheriff's Office, and they worked with a specialist in Santa Cruz to try to test some, you know, 40-year-old DNA, they were able to actually find who they believe is her real killer, which is David Dalrymple. And so Charles worked with volunteer lawyers from, I think, Stoll Rivas, Wendy Olson, and a couple others to actually draft a certificate of innocence stating that he was exonerated and that he was entitled to $1.3 million, almost $1.4 million from the state, based on the Wrongful Conviction Act, which was passed in this legislative session back in March.
Right.
And they've been trying for a couple of years to get that passed. It was vetoed last year. That's under right. one yeah. iteration of the bill, and then they finally got it passed this March. So it's a pretty significant sum that he's getting from the state.
And what are his plans now?
He wants to quit his factory job. He works at a box factory. He's 70-ish now. I think it's 71. And he would like to retire and buy a pickup truck and just kind of live out the rest of his life in peace. And, you know, he said that he forgives everyone involved. And he actually was just thinking of the victim's family, because all this does is remind them of what happened, and they don't get anything from the fact that he's receiving this recognition.
That's really powerful.
Yeah.
Margaret, you were writing about a big talking point in the private and public sectors, and this is carbon neutrality. Boise would like to get to that point by the year 2050. What's it going to take for the city to get there, and what might everyday citizens notice along the way?
So just to start, I'll just define carbon neutrality, because it can be kind of confusing. The carbon neutrality basically means that as a community, we're only putting out as much carbon into the world, you know, as we're taking out. So it doesn't mean carbon free, right? Because there's no electric airplane or some of these other things, but it just means that those things, those debits.
It's release versus capture.
And so the city has kind of three things that they're looking at doing. The first is they want to cut down emissions by quite a lot. And that's for transitioning to working on transitioning to electric vehicles, transitioning buildings, first city buildings, and then working with the private sector onto sources of energy that do not use fossil fuels. And then once they're reducing those emissions using energy efficiency, solar power, wind power, all these sorts of things, then they also want to try to up the amount of carbon that they're taking out of the atmosphere, doing certain things like planting trees. The city's huge tree challenge, where they're trying, they've set a goal for planting a certain number of trees every year. They're giving out trees like crazy.
But it wouldn't be a campaign for this in the city of trees without having a tree element in it.
Right. I mean, it's, we got to live the brand. And exactly. So there's that. And then kind of that last piece of the pie of how you get to that neutral, which I'm told is going to be much more of an issue down the road, is going to be potentially participating in programs to offset, which is basically where the city would agree to participate in a program that would preserve a certain amount of land or do some sort of other environmental project elsewhere in the state or in the region to kind of pay that debt, right? That carbon debt. And so what you're going to see over time, and this transition is not just something happening in the city. Idaho Power is really behind this, is transitioning out of fossil fuels, out and, you know, more talk about electric vehicles. I'm sure we'll see more chargers around in the next 10 years or so, and more solar panels, and just kind of this transition into getting everyone onto a new form of energy. And the city has set up a whole roadmap, different goals and different ways that they can work on this. And these goals, you know, they've broken this into all these different categories like water, energy, environment, and each goal has little, even like mini projects within it. It's called the Climate Roadmap. And so if you're really, really interested in this stuff, I recommend trying to find that on the city's website, because it'll show you really to the detail what they're planning, because it's they've got some significant vision for how they want to achieve this.
Does it incorporate in any way trying to get everyday citizens on board to do things in their everyday lives that help city get closer to this goal?
For sure. The city is definitely wanting to push people to use less car transit to get to work. That's a goal that the city set a couple years ago, which is trying to have reducing the number of single car trips that people, you know, driving to work by yourself, and, you know, using biking and walking in public transit. And also, I think the city is really actively encouraging people to, they're going to be doing more encouraging transitioning people to solar panels and other things like that. This is definitely not something the city is doing alone, or, you know, it's not a mandatory program. But there's going to be, I think, a lot more calls to action here for community members to get involved, but also just the private sector of building, you know, owners, landlords, private businesses that have manufacturing operations here in town. It would not surprise me if large energy users like Micron, which is, you know, a multinational corporation, hops on some of these sorts of initiatives, because I know sustainability is a big priority for them too.
And Scott, we have about 2 minutes left, but I want you to talk a little bit about some reporting that you've done at The Statesman and an editorial that you wrote at The Statesman about memorial signs. ACHD has been putting up these memorial signs along roads. It sounds innocuous, but it isn't.
Right.
Necessarily.
And Idaho Statesman reporter Nicole Blanchard reported about this policy that Ada County Highway District has had since 2015 to put up a memorial sign at the request of a family. And this happened after 13-year-old Olivia Schnacker was hit and killed by a car on Eustick Road in a crosswalk on Eustick Road. Well, earlier this year, the family of a young man who was driving drunk, he had a blood alcohol content of 0.223. He was driving at least 87 miles an hour in a 35 mile an hour zone. He ran a red light, crashed into another car, killed himself, and killed a 15-year-old girl. And the family of that young man requested that they put up a sign in his honor. And that upset the family of the 15-year-old girl and the other two girls who were in that car, were seriously injured.
It was a horrific accident.
Oh, horrific accident, terrible injuries, two deaths. And so the ACHD took the sign down, the family complained, they put the sign back up, the other family complained again. They ended up changing the policy so that folks like this young man are not able to have a sign in their honor. They still have a policy that will allow families to put up signs. And our editorial board was kind of concerned about that, whether that's, you know, Dave McKinney, ACHD Commissioner Dave McKinney said we should just get rid of this policy altogether, let the family put up a memorial, but let's not have government ACHD Commission making these decisions. And that's kind of how the editorial board felt as well.
So the story's not done yet. Well, I want to thank you all. I want to thank our reporter roundtable this week, Kelsey Mosley-Morris from the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, the opinion editor at the Idaho Statesman, and Margaret Carmel, the senior reporter at BoiseDev.com. Thank you all for joining us on Idaho Matters. And I want to thank you for listening. I'm Kevin Richard from Idaho Education News, sitting in for Gemma Gaudette. I want to thank Gemma and the whole team here for letting me fly the plane here the past few weeks. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. If you have a question or a comment or an idea for the show, send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Our executive producers are Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. You can hear today's program and previous interviews at boisestatepublicradio.org. I'm Kevin Richard. Take care.